From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. At this hour, a much-debated $350 billion tax cut package is on the verge of being passed in the House and Senate. Last month, President Bush called $350 billion a little bitty number. But today, he said that he is ready to sign on. The tax cut crowd is cheering. Many economists are not. Tonight on Point, tax cuts in Washington carve the shape of the American future. We begin with the latest on the tax cut package on Capitol Hill. Jonathan Weissman is economic policy reporter with The Washington Post. I asked him where things stand this evening in Congress.
The House will take it up tonight and will pass it tonight. There's no real question about it. The Republicans are very disciplined and they vote for tax cuts. It will probably be fairly much along party lines, and it might not be until the wee hours of the night or the early morning. They actually have not even completed the actual legislation, so they had hoped to perhaps bring it up a little earlier, but the package actually is not written yet.
And then, assuming it comes together, and you're anticipating that it will, it goes to the Senate.
Yes, and I assume that the Senate will pass it. The only real suspense here is whether the tie will have to be broken by Dick Cheney or whether it will simply sail through.
The president went to Capitol Hill today and essentially declared victory with a package considerably smaller than what he had initially requested.
Yeah. As Tom DeLay once said, size doesn't matter much in this context.
Why is that?
They have taken virtually $1 trillion worth of tax cuts and sandwiched them into a $350 billion package through the miracles of sunsetting. Many of these tax cuts, in fact, all of these tax cuts, are considerably shorter than the 10-year span that they are supposed to fill up. When they finished the budget and said it would be $350 billion, that was supposed to be $350 billion through 2013. Well, none of these tax cuts go to 2013. Some of them only go to 2004.
So essentially you're saying, Jonathan, that if and when the sunset comes, but the tax cuts are sustained, and the assumption is that they very likely will be because people don't like to renew taxes, then it will ultimately amount to a $1 trillion cut, even though it looks like $350 billion now?
That's right.
Jonathan Weissman, walk us through, if you'd be good enough, the likely impact at different income levels, different household incomes. How will it show up? What will people see?
If you pay income tax, you will get a tax cut. All income tax rates will drop to the rate that they were supposed to fall to in 2006.
And that will happen as early as July.
Yes. And in fact, it's going to be a little bit larger of a bump up than you would actually see next year because the tax cuts are retroactive to the beginning of this year. So this year's paychecks will actually reflect a slightly higher number because they're going to be playing catch-up from the beginning of the year.
So how much more, I know it's hard to say every family has different circumstances, but what kind of scale of reduced taxation or how much bigger paycheck is it likely to produce at different levels of income?
Actually, Deloitte & Touche just ran some numbers. Families with children under 17 are going to do considerably better because one of the major portions of the individual income tax cuts are an expansion of the child credit from $600 to $1,000. Mm-hmm. So a married couple with two children earning a household income of $63,000 okay. would see a tax cut of about $1,100.
Over the year?
In 2003. Now, right. In 2005, the marriage penalty cut and the child cut would end and things would revert back to current law. So of that $1,100, they would actually give back $700, and then the tax cut becomes a $400 tax cut.
So a brief bump, assuming yeah. the sunset is there. What about for higher-income families?
For higher-income families, let's say a single person with no children earning $530,000 would get a tax cut of $12,838.
Not too bad.
No, not too bad. There have been some new numbers run that do suggest that the higher you go up, the larger the break you get, and the more of an increase in your total net worth you will get. It's not just a dollar amount better. You're also getting a higher percentage of the tax cut because such a huge amount of this tax cut is a cut to the taxation on dividends and capital gains. And most people in the lowest income brackets don't get too much dividend income or capital gains.
You write that about 80% of dividend income goes to higher income households. So overall, stepping back and looking at this, Jonathan, the lion's share goes to high income households?
I would think that's correct to say. Now, if you are a supporter of the tax cut, you would say that that is beside the point, because the tax cut ostensibly is not to give people money per se, it is to boost the economy. And these cuts that are aimed at investors are supposed to incent more investment. Investment will give money to corporations, and then they will be able to hire more people.
The dividend cut, the president pushed very hard for. He got something of a cut, not a complete cut, and again, with the sunset piece there.
That's right. President Bush put a considerable amount of personal political capital into the idea of eliminating the double taxation of dividends. He didn't just propose this, he campaigned very hard for it. The White House was actually ridiculing House Ways and Means Committee Chairman Bill Thomas's proposal to simply lower capital gains taxes and dividend taxes to the same 15% rate. Well, now they are claiming victory, but you must understand that the president did not get what he wanted. He wanted something that was fairly dramatic, eliminating taxation on dividends from fully taxed corporate earnings. Mm-hmm. The idea was not just that you were going to give a tax break to investors, but that you were going to create huge, powerful new incentives for companies to pay out dividends, to get their finances in order, to stop trying to avoid taxation, that it would really create a wave of good corporate stewardship.
And are Republicans saying that that will not happen, given the fact that they didn't get the complete elimination of these taxes?
It will not happen, not necessarily because they didn't get the elimination, but because they did not get this very complicated structure that the president had, which would make sure that you could only give tax-free dividends off income that was fully taxed. In other words, there would be a new incentive for companies not to avoid paying taxes, that their shareholders would say to their companies, hey, don't shelter all your income, don't avoid taxation, because every dollar that you avoid taxation is a dollar that I'm not getting in a tax-free dividend.
A nice tax-free dividend. And finally, Jonathan Wiseman, what about the impact ultimately on the deficit? I realize that's difficult to say because the sunset provisions tend to camouflage that impact. How do you size it up?
Actually, a new estimate that came out today said that with this tax cut, the deficit for this year will be $416 billion. That's an estimate from the House Budget Committee Democrats, but it is also in line with most Wall Street estimates.
And how much higher is that than what was projected previously before this legislation?
$416 billion, to put this into perspective, the record budget deficit that came in the first Bush administration was $290 billion. Even adjusted for inflation, $416 billion is a record. And you're adding, I think, about $40 billion to the deficit before this. To be fair, the Democrats also wanted to do a fairly significant short-term tax cut, so they also would have added considerable amount of money to the deficit.
And if we project further out, Jonathan Wiseman, assuming that when the sunset times come, the taxes don't actually rebound, but they're voted in again, what's the long-term impact on the deficit front?
Well, they're fairly dramatic. If you just look at the Congressional Budget Office's estimate of what would happen to the budget deficit if President Bush got all of the proposals that he has put out in his last budget. Basically, the president's proposals were going to increase the debt by over $2 trillion.
So can we do that and still have all the things Americans expect from the federal government, or does it mean a different federal government?
Well, this president, at least, has not made a big kick out of cutting government. If you are willing to simply finance tax cuts and government spending through more and more debt, it wouldn't change the composition of the government. The problem is that eventually the bill will come due. We just don't know exactly when.
Jonathan Wiseman, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Jonathan Wiseman is economic policy reporter with The Washington Post. He spoke with me earlier from the Senate Press Gallery on Capitol Hill. In the next 24 hours, Congress will very likely finalize passage of a $350 billion tax cut package. It is $200 billion short of the cut President Bush was lobbying for last month. but the administration is already calling the anticipated passage of the tax plan a victory for the president and for the country. Critics are deeply skeptical, warning that the cuts will come at the expense of fundamental social programs like Social Security and Medicare, and will deepen the economic divide in America. Where do you stand on the Bush tax cuts? Where are we headed here? To economic stimulus and a bright future, or to deficits, inequality, and broken commitments? What is the economic reality that you see being shaped in Washington for the decades ahead? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New Haven, Connecticut, is the celebrated economist Robert Shiller, professor of economics at Yale University. He is author of Irrational Exuberance, the book that foretold the 90s bubble going bust, and of The New Financial Order, Risk in the 21st Century. Good evening and welcome, Robert Shiller.
Good evening.
Good evening. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. Robert Shiller, just last week, you had an op-ed piece entitled Mind the Gap in the New York Times, saying, watch out, the tax packages on the table in Congress are likely to drastically aggravate income inequality in the United States, and we need a whole new way of calculating taxation, one that will push us toward more equal incomes, not less. Tonight, that is clearly not part of the package, and the package is going through. What's on your mind as an economist looking out over this landscape?
Well, I wanted to get this point out during this debate, although the Republican Congress is not likely to like my ideas. But I think that actually, even if you go beyond the current tax situation, there's a risk of increasing inequality in this country. The trend has been toward increasing inequality. In 1970, the bottom 40% of the population in the U.S. earned 18% of the income. By 1998, it was down to 14%. We don't know where it's going to go from here. But I think there's reasons to suspect that it could get substantially worse. And I think that we should be thinking about making our tax system more progressive, not less progressive.
But as you sit back tonight and look at what is actually happening on Capitol Hill, how do you see the impact of this tax package on this one factor, income equality or inequality?
Well, it's quite a substantial change. Of course, when you the Bush administration wants to, it says it wants to stimulate the economy by cutting taxes rather than raising expenditures, which would be the other Keynesian way. If you're going to cut taxes, it has to come from the fairly wealthy people who pay most of the taxes. So given that, I think this is a logical outcome. We should be probably considering raising government expenditure as another Keynesian tool rather than this tax cuts. But that's really not political right now.
So in the 90s, you wrote about irrational exuberance, and we all know what happened then. Do you see a new kind of exuberance in the tax cutting going on right here, right now, and do you support it, or does it concern you?
Well, the rationale for these tax cuts, that they will invigorate the economy, is a popular theory that has some merit. I suppose it will have that effect somewhat. I mean, I'm glad to see that at least we're doing something about this slow period right now. But I think that Republicans have exaggerated the extent to which this is the right thing to do to stimulate the economy. One issue is it's often said that high-income people are discouraged from working hard by high tax rates. Mm. But, you know, I don't think it's that much of an effect. If we drop the top rate from 38.6 to 35, it's not going to have much effect on the people's willingness to work. So I think it's a bit exaggerated.
Do you see these tax cuts feeding into your fearful prospect of greater income inequality, social strife, and the rest?
Well, they will contribute to it. I think that there's a risk. See, the thing is, we're really going the wrong way. I think that taxes should be getting more progressive at this point. And what I said in my op-ed piece is that, and this is not something that's immediately political. Again, I threw it out as where we ideally would do things. We should set up a tax system. If we're going to plan 10 years out, we should set up a tax system that responds to the level of inequality. And so it should say in the tax law that if inequality gets worse, the taxes will get more progressive.
So that it would in effect, dampen those inequalities rather than exaggerate them. Robert Shaler, stand by. We've got a lot to talk about tonight and some great guests who are going to be joining you momentarily. We are talking tonight about the Bush tax cuts coming out of Congress this very evening and what they mean for the American economy and your life. You can join the conversation. Where are we headed here? To economic stimulus and a bright future, or to deficits, inequality, and broken commitments? Are you popping open the champagne tonight or collecting soda bottles to pay for your retirement? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the new Bush tax cuts coming out of Congress this very evening and what they mean for the American economy and for your life. You can join the conversation. What is the message in the tax cut? What kind of nation will it help shape? Can we have tax cuts and Social Security, Medicare? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest tonight is Robert Shaler, professor of economics at Yale University and author of The New Financial Order, Risk in the 21st Century, and joining us now from Chicago, Thomas Frank. He's editor of The Baffler and author of One Market Under God, the cover story in the June issue of Harper's Get Rich or Get Out Attempted Robbery with a Loaded Federal Budget. Good evening and welcome, Thomas Frank.
Hey, how you doing?
Very well. Thanks for joining us tonight. Also joining us from Monterey, California, David R. Henderson, research fellow with the Hoover Institute at Stanford University and author of The Joy of Freedom, An Economist's Odyssey. Good evening and welcome, David R. Henderson.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks so much for joining us. Tom Frank, if I may turn to you first, give us your big interpretation of what's going on tonight on Capitol Hill.
Well, let's see. There's, in my opinion, and probably in a lot of other people's opinion as well, there's two main reasons why Republicans like tax cuts. One of them is, of course, that it, you know, puts a little ka-ching in the pockets of their constituents, right? It makes the inequality worse, makes the rich richer, so on. The other is that it defunds government. This is, I think this is something that we don't talk about enough, you know? It really wouldn't matter what tax we were cutting. It could be completely counterproductive. It wouldn't matter. The thing is to ratchet up that deficit and make the problems down the road that much worse.
Why?
To what end?
To what end, Thomas?
A lot of the Republicans in Congress, and I'm thinking in particular here of people like Santorum and DeLay and Brownback and people like that, are frankly anti-government types. They sincerely believe that government causes more problems than it's worth. You remember the famous Ronald Reagan, the thing that he said in his first inaugural address, government isn't the solution to our problems, government is our problem.
Yes.
And you got to remember for the business community, which is after all the main constituency for the Republican Party, the business community regards government by and large as a deeply irritating, meddlesome social institution, and so, they have ever since the 1930s.
So when you looked into the 2004 budget, and that's really what you're writing about in the Harper essay, very tough essay, again, attempted robbery with a loaded federal budget, you write the 2004...
Like tough to read?
No, I mean it's hard-hitting. You write, the 2004 budget is toxic. It is an epic of distortion and evasion and contradiction and misleading rhetorical ploys. The object of this malodorous epic is to outline the Bush administration's plan for plunging the nation from surplus into deficit and cast the blame for the ensuing disaster on the very people, the poor, who will feel the brunt of its effects. What is in there that's so hideous in your eyes, Thomas Frank?
Well, I should say I was this might strike you as kind of amusing, but I was reviewing the budget like one would, you know, a literary text. They actually, the Harper's got the, you know, they went out and somehow got a copy of the thing, right? All five volumes of it, and each of them the size of a phone book, and they had it delivered to my house, and I sat down and read it. And so a lot of those critiques have to do with the way that the thing is put together and the sort of rhetorical ploys that it engages in. And there is a lot of deception in it and a lot of passages that can only have – I mean that are – well, I'll just say intentionally misleading. There's a lot of talk about Social Security is the real problem. The Social Security is going to cause the real budget deficit somewhere down the road, even as it proposes these massive tax cuts, which are in fact – plunging us into deficit.
So, your bottom line here is that this is not really about stimulus. It's not even in some level about tax cuts. It's about an ideology of dismantling government. David R. Henderson, come in here with us. When you look out at what's happening on Capitol Hill tonight, how do you see it? Is this a disaster? Are these the seeds of a bright new day dawning?
Well, both extremes are overstated. I think it's a good policy. I think it's a good proposal. And I think it's that way for a few reasons. One is that it will encourage investment, and investment is one of the drivers of economic growth. And in fact, because of that, you can't say for sure that it will increase inequality. And the reason is that with more capital investment, with more capital per laborer, real wages will be higher than otherwise. And so it's really hard to say. The people who are saying it will definitely cause inequality are just making an assertion, really. We don't have enough evidence to say one way or the other. Now, I do agree with Thomas Franks that the budget is a disaster. I mean, any time the government is spending over 20% of GDP, that's not good. And so, yes, it's a disaster.
So you agree with the word disaster, but for quite a different reason. You're saying let's reduce this further.
That's right. Most of what government spends on is wasteful. You spend your better, Tom, than the government would for you. You'll take better care of your kids if you have them than the government will take care of them. So I think it is a disaster. And this is a modest little movement away from disaster.
But a disaster for very, very different reasons than Thomas Frank is seeing. Robert Shiller, come in here if you would for us to really the what appears to be, beyond the talk of stimulus, the heart of this debate. And I must say, having talked with people on the right and left, this issue of dismantling government, of drastically reducing spending on government, seems to be at the heart of both sides' arguments, whether they're for or against that. Where do you come down on this great big ideological, assault or a challenge to government as we've known it?
Well, I think that the bigger issue is the effects on distribution, on inequality. So, I mean, we could the point is that we want to take care of the low-income people in our population who are increasingly hurting.
But you're using so, "we" perhaps too easily. Is there a consensus on that, do you believe?
There's no consensus on this. This is a highly political issue. What I'm saying is if we were to raise taxes and pay for education or something like that for the low-income people, education in this country is suffering because of state budget problems. Universities are not growing. That's one example of the way that we can redistribute, and it could even be done through, hiring private schools to do the educating. It doesn't have to be a government school.
But David Henderson represents
the redistribution.
But David Henderson represents a GOP.
Can I speak for myself?
One moment, please. I just want to get this out. The notion that if we reduce absolutely the percentage of national wealth spent on government, that this will come back in benefits for the entire society, Robert Shiller. Do you accept that?
Well, that is conceivable. If it happens, then we can reverse the tax changes. You know, I'm talking about making taxes more progressive. Again, I'm talking about what I would like to see. And I think the tax system should respond to this level of inequality. And there's no mechanism in place for that. And I think that would be the most important change if we could get that change made.
David Henderson.
Tom, I just want to point something out to your listeners. You've had two people who've been critical of the Bush tax cut. You gave them lots of questions. They had lots of time to answer. You asked me one question. We're talking about basic fairness here. This is incredibly unfair.
David Henderson, don't be so thin-skinned. We've got time to go, and our ears are wide open to you. What do you make of Robert Shiller's response?
Let's look at the issue of inequality for a minute. Robert Shiller talks about the issue of inequality. We don't know what the effect, but let me point something out. He interchangeably uses the concept of inequality and the poor hurting, and those are two different issues. You could have increasing inequality with everyone being better off. The point is,
with everyone being better off, meaning the rich would get so much richer that the poor might be better off as well, but not as much better off.
Right.
So the gap would grow.
The gap would grow, but everyone's better off. In fact, if you look at the 90s, that's what happened.
Robert Shiller, is there a problem in the gap itself?
He has a good point that people who studied income distribution have pointed out that the lower income people have been growing in their incomes despite the increasing inequality.
That's right.
But I think that doesn't I think that the situation the relative income is still very important. And this is brought out in a recent book by Barbara Ehrenreich called Nickel and Dimed, where she went and tried to live among the lowest income people in this country. And I don't think a lot of people appreciate the effect of those differences on people's lives. It affects them in so many ways, and that they shouldn't share as well in the growth of this country is a tragedy.
They do share, and you just admitted they share. It's just their share doesn't grow as much. I mean, their share shrinks, but it's a share of a bigger amount, and so they do get more. So they are sharing in the growth, just not
the other thing is, what I was really arguing in my op-ed piece was not against the Bush task plan, the details of it. It was the mechanism. I think that we should stand ready to make the tax system more progressive in the future if the trend continues. And right now, it's 14% of the national income is earned by in 1998 by the bottom 40%. That could fall to 10% or less. And I think
actually,
we should be ready. We don't know what will happen.
With your tax increases, the percent earned by the higher income people will go up. Because if you're looking at before tax income, think about it this way.
No, it's after tax. Sorry.
Okay, so you're talking after tax through the.
Well, that's all that matters.
Tom Frank, I want to bring you in here. I know you've got a different view from each of the our other guests tonight, and a fairly fiery one on the luxury front. What do you make of this conversation?
Well, I would say first of all that. In fact, I don't think the 90s were as wonderful as everybody thinks. The Ehrenreich book is a fantastic – the one that Mr. Schiller, remarked on,
yes.
Nickel and Dime, is a fantastic look at the way that that people in the working class live nowadays. And in fact, wages really didn't increase all that much in the 1990s with a few exceptions. And you can talk about, maybe things got better for the people at the very bottom. But who is to say how much, better than that they could have been? You know, these are arguments that are ultimately impossible to judge, but if you look at other industrialized countries, if you look at other countries in our same situation, they just don't have the same kind of extremes. They don't have the same kind of poverty. Let me tell you, I'm working on a different project now, and it involved going to a meatpacking town in western Kansas.
All right.
This is an industry where they busted the unions in the 1980s,
mm-hmm.
and moved the slaughterhouses way out into the most distant places that they could find, and imported populations of people, very very poor people whom they pay. Poverty level wages, and they do this intentionally. It's calculated, and it's straight out of Karl Marx. These people are, and I'm not saying my interpretation is, but that the way that the capitalists, the people who own these things, are behaving, is it's real 19th century. Mm.
Tom Frank, David Henderson, Robert Shaler, please stand by. We have a lot of callers who want to join this conversation. I want to invite them in. Justin's calling from Lowell, Massachusetts. Hi, Justin. You're on the air.
Yes, I am. Thank you very much.
Hi.
I'm a planner by trade, and I'm 24 years old, so I tend
did you
to
say
try to,
did, Justin, did you say planner or plumber?
I'm a planner.
Okay.
So I tend to try to look at the long term picture of things and the big picture, and as a 24 year old, I'm very concerned about the what the Bush administration is promoting here, which is essentially these huge tax cuts and increasing spending on military and defense and cutting local aid to states, which in turn is cutting local aid to education. So what is going to be the long-term benefit of the deficit that really my generation is going to be left to deal with?
But Justin, what about the notion that this will spark economic growth, which will make that less burdensome?
I don't really believe that the trickle-down theory works.
David Henderson, let me turn that to you. David Henderson, how would you respond to Justin?
Yeah, I agree. It's not trickle down. It's gush down. The point is that if you look at the whole 20th century with the people who are now considered poor would have been considered rich 80 years ago. Look at the things we have that virtually everyone has, CD players, microwaves, televisions, cars. 71% of the people officially defined as poor have cars. So it is not trickle down, it's gush down, and that's really the story of economic growth.
The Jodes had a car too when they drove to California in 1932.
And we got much better cars today, and you don't have to drive to California. You can find a job much more locally.
Robert Shaler, cast your mind forward. What do you see as Justin, our 24-year-old planner, wants to look ahead?
Well, I should add that David Henderson has some the principles he's espousing of creating incentives for economic growth and then depending on the economic growth to lift everyone up, they're valid. In fact, they're respected all over the world.
Absolutely. Right.
And so more, I mean, in China, that's supposed to be communist China, but they sound like Republican China.
Yes, they do.
They're not a high-tax country. And they're depending on self-reliance. So I'm not questioning that basic fact, but already our tax system is not that progressive, and we, you know, compared to other countries, and it's okay to move back. Just does not seem very appealing at a time when we're getting more unequal, and where I think really there's a threat of substantially increased inequality. So it's just not the right move. I'm not saying that I would want to completely take the money away. People tend to assume that that it's a foot in the door, that if we're going to raise taxes on the rich, we're going to move them up to 100%. Well, I would obviously oppose that.
Robert Shiller, let me ask you about the deficit point here that Justin also raised. Do you see a large deficit coming out of this tax cut and the two we've already had? Is that a problem or is that surmountable?
Well, for the short run, it's what we want. We want to stimulate the economy. And
I wouldn't want that.
Well,
one moment, please, David. What do you mean for the short run? And you're saying don't let it grow too big, too long.
Well, the question, see, the recession started in March of 2001, so that's like 26 months ago. And it's probably got a while. Well, we may not be technically in a recession, but we're in a slow period for some time. But it'll probably come up in the next 8, 10, 12 months. But I'd like to give it a little boost. But these tax cuts are not ending in 12 months. They will go on for years.
And our caller's 24. He wants to look ahead. What do you see 30 years out?
Well, that's a difficult question. 30 years out, the world will be very different.
But isn't that where Social Security becomes a big
right.
difficulty?
And my fear, I'll give you, nobody can predict 30 years out, but I have a fear about a much more unequal society, which would be shocking to see if we could move forward in that. And that's not because of Republicans. It's because of the changes in the economy. The world is a very unequal place. And in a capitalist economy, people have to survive on their own ability in the marketplace to offer their – and it may not become more unequal, but there's a fear to me that it would.
David Henderson, does that bother you that it might
– That what might? That it might become more unequal?
Yes.
No, as I said, if everyone's getting more, that's great. And in fact, the more inequality you have with everyone getting more, the more incentive you have for people to produce things. I mean, think of it this way. Let's say that suddenly the 1,000 best baseball players in the United States died. Baseball would be substantially less good. Similarly, take the highest earning million people in this country, the top 1%, and if they died suddenly, we would have a much less productive economy. People talk about how much money these people get. What they don't point out is they get it because that's what they're producing.
And why don't you care about the deficit? Why don't you care about the deficit, David Henderson?
More.
Why don't you care about the deficit? I'm just curious. In a nutshell.
No, I do care about. Remember, I'm the one who said a minute ago that I don't want the deficit to go up. I'd be much more happy with this tax cut. I favor the tax cut, but I'd be much more comfortable with it if Bush would come up with dollar for dollar spending cuts.
So bring the government down. We've got to take a short break. Stand by, David Henderson, Thomas Frank, Robert Shiller. We're talking tonight about the new Bush tax cuts coming out of Congress tonight and what they mean for the American economy and your life. Do you believe that the tax cuts for the rich will make jobs for the poor? And what's the road we're getting onto here? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the new Bush tax cuts coming out of Congress this very evening and what they mean for the American economy and for your life. My guest tonight, Robert Shiller, economist at Yale University, author of Irrational Exuberance, joining us from New Haven, Connecticut. In Monterey, California, David R. Henderson, research fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University and author of The Joy of Freedom, An Economist's Odyssey. And from Chicago tonight, Thomas Frank, editor of The Baffler and author of the cover story in the June issue of Harper's, Get Rich or Get Out, Attempted Robbery with a Loaded Federal Budget. You can join the conversation as well. What is the message in the tax cut? What kind of nation will it help? help shape? And is this about stimulus or ideology or both? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Angelica is calling from McHenry, Illinois. Hi, Angelica. You're on the air.
Hi, I'm a 28-year-old engineer, and I have worked in three companies since I graduated from college.
Okay.
And they've all been manufacturers of, you know, various kinds of goods, whether it's, you know, industrial goods or consumer goods. And this is, you know, still back in the 90s when things were still quote-unquote good.
Yeah.
And all the manufacturing has moved abroad. And my feeling about this tax cut is that I feel that, you know, yeah, the rich can go ahead and invest, and, you know, that will open jobs abroad, because all the manufacturing really is abroad. And I really am curious to know what kind of jobs the Republicans think that this is going to open up. I mean, is it going to be manufacturing? Is it going to be accounting for the rich? Is it going to be stock brokers for the rich? Is it going to be more service?
We will raise the question, Angelica. Thanks for raising it. David Henderson, it sounds like one for you.
Okay. I think that the thing is, you can't tell what kind of jobs there'll be. The fact is, in a market economy with changing consumer tastes, with changing technology, we can't predict where, you know, what people are going to want to buy, but what they will buy, we know people will supply. Now, it's true, as Angelica points out, they might buy manufactured goods from abroad, but then they're going to make more goods here or services here or something to generate the revenues to pay for those goods. And so, I don't know if she's thinking that trade isn't good, not that she said that, but
I think she's thinking that she's worried that the investment's going to go abroad and not someplace where it's going to benefit her with the job.
Yeah, well, and it might. Sorry. And it might. It might go abroad, but the point is that it will make the investment climate here better, too, and so there'll be more investment, probably more investment abroad and more investment here. But the point is, we can't know which jobs will be created. That's why socialism failed, because they tried to plan an economy, and you basically can't.
Thomas Frank, I hear you there.
Yeah, I was just going to say it's another you know, story that I know something about. And yeah, of course they'll move the jobs wherever we'll let them to, wherever they can find the lowest wages. And there's no guarantee that the free market will provide for us here at all.
Robert Shiller.
Yeah, the world is incredibly unequal. The per capita GDP in 2000 in India was 7% of the U.S., and in China it was 11%. We are protected somewhat from this inequality by trade barriers, by geographical barriers, but all these things are having less of an impact, less of a protection, because globalization is proceeding and because electronic commerce is becoming more important.
So what's the choice? Don't we have to operate in that environment?
So she is absolutely right. Angelica is absolutely right.
But there is a global economy. But there is a global economy.
I'm all for globalization, but I think that we have to protect people from the consequences of that.
And how would
some
you do that?
Well, there's various ways. I wrote a book about this.
But are we talking tax policy here? Or
That's one way of doing it. Right. One way. This should be the big national issue. And it's not – you know, people like Angelica bring it up because it's so obvious that this is a problem. When the world is so unequal, how do we know that it's not going to come over to our shores? And I think she's absolutely right. And
but are you suggesting
is one way of starting to think about that?
Are you suggesting, Robert Shiller, that the Americans can somehow build a bulwark of less inequality in the United States that will affect the whole globe? Doesn't the globe kind of go the way it goes, no matter what U.S. policy is?
Well, I hope that other countries would do this, do similar things. And there's progressive taxes in most advanced countries of the world right now. In fact, they're mostly more progressive than the U.S.
I want to get more callers in here. Ricardo's calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. Hi, Ricardo. You're on the air.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I have a couple of quick points to make.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
One is the alleged proposal that this administration had of having $500 billion injected back into the economy by hopefully having this money create new jobs, create a million new jobs, I think they said. Why not? That's $500,000 per job that they're proposing to create. Why not just have it go directly to the people that need it, create that million jobs by subsidizing a million
jobs? I mean, what do you want? Do you want people with shovels out along the roadside? Or what are you suggesting, Ricardo?
Well, the money could be, for example, given to the states to rehire all those people that were laid off over the past couple of years, all those state and city workers.
Okay, we got that point. You have a second point, Ricardo?
Yes, I do have a second point. If all these tax cuts are supposed to be stimulating the economy and creating new jobs, why haven't jobs been created over the past couple of years with the tax cuts that have happened recently?
Got it. David Henderson, let us put it to you.
Well, I think that Bush has sold the plan in various ways. He's had to talk to a country that's been steeped in Keynesian economics, and that's part of the problem. So he's always talking about how this money will create new jobs. That's not how I justify it at all. This money will increase the incentive to invest. It will also change the disincentive to pay in the form of dividends, which will affect the capital structure, and we'll get better jobs. I don't know how many more we'll get, but we will get better jobs. We will get better investment. We will get less of a distortion in where investment goes. That's my big case for it.
All this is happening tonight on Capitol Hill. Our time is running down here, but I want to hear from each of you as we go out on where you think this economy, this country is headed with the impetus of these tax cuts and those that have come before. Tom Frank, let me turn first to you. Just paint a picture of where you see us going.
Well, let's see. Let me give you a really broad overview. The thing that's missing from our national conversation and from this conversation as well, and the thing that distinguishes us from every other industrialized country in the world, is the fact that we have systematically destroyed organized labor here. You bring that voice back into the debate, you would have a very, very different outcome from top to bottom. I mean, some of the things that we've heard here tonight are absurd. They're ridiculous. The idea of the market rewards CEOs with the appropriate levels of pay. It's preposterous. Look at Enron. Look at what's going on in my home state of Kansas, where the local utility, the share price has dropped 70% and the CEO, got away with $70 million.
So you say bring back labor as a break on big money. David Henderson, our time's running down, but we go to you. Where are we headed here?
Well, I think I'll do it with by reference to Thomas's thing. One of the reasons Enron happened is they don't pay dividends. Dividends are a constraint in a firm, and this tax cut will encourage firms to pay dividends. The other reason Enron happened that people aren't talking about much is all the laws passed in the late 80s that make it hard to take over a company, so shareholders aren't protected. The shareholders of Enron were the ones who were screwed.
So you're saying even less regulation would have helped avoid Enron?
Yeah, avoiding these regulations that made it very hard to take over companies would have put the managers on notice, as was happening in the 80s.
And Robert Shiller, the last word goes to you tonight. Here we are. Congress is busy at it right now. Of course, this comes on the heels of other major tax cuts. Where do you see the country headed?
First, I should say, David Henderson made some interesting and good points. Particularly, I like the dividend tax cut, if that could be compensated for, because that was discouraging investment, and investment will produce growth.
Mm-hmm.
But overall, I think that, yes, where is this country going? We're seeing rapid advance of technology and globalization. These are facts of life. The technology is increasing productivity, and that will make some people very well off. What's happening right now is employers are laying off people. They've got higher productivity. They're trying to protect their bottom line, and so they're doing mass layoffs. But this is just a harbinger of what could happen in a rapidly changing economy. Some quick-thinking people, young people with the right education, the right position, will become very rich, and lots of people will be left behind. And that's the thing that we should really be worrying about now.
Americans, fasten your seatbelts. David Henderson, I want to thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
David Henderson joined us from Monterey, California. He's a research fellow with the Hoover Institution at Stanford University and author of The Joy of Freedom, An Economist's Odyssey. Thomas Frank in Chicago, thank you for being with us this evening.
Sure thing.
Tom Frank is editor of The Baffler and author of One Market Under God and the cover story in the June issue of Harper's Get Rich or Get Out, Attempted Robbery with a Loaded Federal Budget. And Robert Shiller in New Haven, Connecticut, thanks for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
Robert Shiller is professor of economics at Yale University and author of Irrational Exuberance and more recently, The New Financial Order, Risk in the 21st Century. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, a Pulitzer Prize-winning writer is booed off the commencement stage at Rockford College. This is On Point. Seasoned New York Times war correspondent Christopher Hedges knows how to prepare for battle. The fierce response to Hedges' commencement address on Saturday at Rockford College in northern Illinois, however, caught him off guard. Hedges' speech was critical of the unilateral direction of America's foreign policy since 9/11. Hostile spectators booed, shouted for him to leave, and drowned him out with patriotic slogans. We begin here after two interruptions and a call for respect and tolerance of Hedge's opinions by college president Paul Pribinow. Of his onstage hazing, Hedges said, quote, "Watching it in my own country is heartbreaking." In this excerpt of his speech, you'll hear an interruption when the podium mic is unplugged by an audience member.
I want to speak to you today about war and empire. War allows us to rise above our small stations in life. We find nobility in a cause and feelings of selflessness and even bliss. And at a time of soaring deficits and financial scandals and the very deterioration of our domestic fabric, war is a fine diversion. War for those who enter into combat has a dark beauty, filled with the monstrous and the grotesque. The Bible calls it the lust of the eye and warns believers against it. War gives us a distorted sense of self. It gives us meaning.
Can I say a few words, please?
Once in war, when I finish, yeah. The conflict obliterates the past and the future. All is one heady, intoxicating present. You feel every heartbeat in war. Colors are brighter. Your mind races ahead of it. You want to... Is it on? Should I keep going? It's up to you. That's up to the president of your college. It's not up to me.
Why don't you go back to see if you want to get to the... Why don't we bring it to a close?
All right. Bring it to a close. Go ahead. We feel in wartime comradeship. We confuse this with friendship, with love. There are those who will insist that the comradeship of war is love. The ecstatic glow that makes us in war feel as one people, one entity is real. This is part of war's intoxication. Think back on the days after the attacks on 9/11. Suddenly, we no longer felt alone. We connected with strangers, even with people we did not like. We felt we belonged, that we were somehow wrapped in the embrace of the nation, the community. In short, we no longer felt alienated. As this feeling dissipated in the weeks after the attack, there was a kind of nostalgia for its warm glow. And wartime always brings with it this comradeship, which is the opposite of friendship. Friends, as J. Glenn Gray points out, are predetermined. Friendship takes place between men and women who possess an intellectual and emotional affinity for each other. But comradeship, that ecstatic bliss that comes with belonging to the crowd in wartime, is within our reach. In wartime, when we feel threatened, we no longer face death alone, but as a group, and this makes death easier to bear. We ennoble self-sacrifice for the other, for the comrade. In short, we begin to worship death, and this is what the God of War demands us. Think, finally, of what it means to die for a friend. It is deliberate and painful. There is no ecstasy. For friends, dying is hard and bitter. The dialogue they have and cherish will perhaps never be recreated. Friends do not, the way comrades do, love death and sacrifice. And this is why friendship, or let me say love, is the most potent enemy of war. Thank you.
A rough but astonishing piece of tape. Christopher Hedges addresses a vigorously booing graduating class at Rockford College in Rockford, Illinois. He is a reporter for the New York Times and author of War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. You can read the full transcript of his speech at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is W.